Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we're glad to have back with us Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And every other month on a Monday, we do the show and we call it Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is that we can take a wide range of questions. He sees people of all ages in his practice, grown-ups, children, people with a wide variety of health concerns. And we're here to try to help you out. We cannot diagnose over the phone. Hope people can keep that in mind. If you have a real serious issue, you want to take that up with somebody who can see you. But this is a good place to start. You can ask some basic questions and talk a little bit about healthcare, add to your knowledge, and then, of course, if you have real concern, you want to take that to your own physician. But this is a place for you to start. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and we'll pay for the call. And that's 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you got questions, you can give us a call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Good to be back.
I was thinking about, I'm sure that for everybody, if you're not feeling well, there's this point where you're having this conversation with yourself or maybe somebody in your family about, all right, do I call the doctor or do I not? Now, I guess we would hope that if you were having chest pains or something like that, you do not delay.
Not hesitate too much.
Don't hesitate. But there might be other cases where you're thinking, well, I mean, I'm not sure. Something's going on, but I'm not sure what. I don't even know how I'm going to describe what it is I think that I'm feeling. It could be that it'll, whatever it is, it's self-limiting. And I guess I wonder, I expect that studies have been done of what people think about when they're trying to make that decision, okay, do I go or not? How do people make that decision?
I think everybody does that on an individual basis based on their own previous history in terms of their own medical history and their interactions with the healthcare system. Somebody who's generally in good health, who has relatively minor symptoms, that person will probably either figure out for themselves or even be advised to say, well, give it a couple of days and, kind of see what happens. Because as you point out, a number of things are fairly self-limiting. Somebody who has multiple medical problems, who's developing symptoms that could be a complication, probably shouldn't sit around and wait and figure out if it's going to turn out to be really bad. Just like the guy with chest pain who thinks it's indigestion. Mm-hmm. In the proper setting, the set of symptoms can be interpreted quite differently. If an otherwise healthy person says, gee, I've got this little twinge in my chest, well, that's probably not too much to worry about. But the older person with multiple risk factors for heart disease who says, gee, I've got this pressure sensation, so you can't really say, well, chest pain is chest pain. It always has to be interpreted in light of that individual's own unique circumstances. And I always encourage our patients, if you have a question, if you have a concern, call. Let somebody, from outside your own perspective kind of look at it and give you some advice. If it sounds suspicious, then we'll make arrangements to have you seen and check it out further. Yeah. If it sounds like something that could be temporized and check back in another day or two and see how things are going, that's oftentimes a very efficient way of handling. Mm.
Other than chest pain, is there any symptom that you would say, if you're feeling this, don't ignore it?
The symptoms of chest pain, especially in middle-aged or older adults, especially if they have any underlying cardiovascular risk factors, really shouldn't be ignored. In the majority of cases, it's not, the big one. You're not having a heart attack. But it's best to have it evaluated, if only over the phone, initially. Anything that includes a significant alteration in function, I think, probably deserves at least a discussion with your healthcare provider. Again, it may indeed turn out to be temporary or self-limited. But if it either hurts that bad or it causes you to not be able to do something that you were able to do before easily, and it doesn't have some ready explanation, you know, like I fell down the stairs and now my ankles are, then it probably bears checking out.
Okay. We have a caller here. Perhaps we'll get some others. We'll start out with someone who is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hello. Dr. Swanson, I have a question, maybe on semantics, perhaps. I'm following the case of my 96-year-old cousin a couple of times removed. And she was removed from her house and deemed incompetent. And she's had... I've heard a couple of different diagnoses, and nobody seems to be able to really pin anything down. They seem to have ruled out Alzheimer's. We were going with dementia, and then yet another doctor has thrown in short-term memory loss. Now, my understanding of short-term memory loss is that it's more of a symptom than an actual diagnosis. So
that is correct.
I guess I'm curious. I'm curious as to your opinion on that. Yeah. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
If that's all right.
Sure. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
The difficulties, which are sort of globally referred to as cognitive impairment, become increasingly more common as people get older. It used to be thought that, you know, old age by itself was a cause for dementia, and that's really not truly the case. Elderly individuals who are otherwise in good health should have fairly normal cognitive function, though like with everything else as we get older, things may be a little slower than it used to be, but still should function pretty normally. Dementia refers to a wide category of numerous diagnoses, one of which is, in fact, Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's turns out to be one of the more common causes of dementias, but there are many other potential causes as well. The vast majority of diagnoses that include dementia as a primary symptom, unfortunately, usually aren't very treatable. And as such, it's usually very reasonable at least once to thoroughly look at somebody whose mentation has changed, looking for underlying causes that could potentially be reversible. There are folks who turn out to be profoundly hypothyroid. Their thyroid is so underactive that they just don't think straight. And that's a very simple, easy, and very gratifying thing to find and fix because they come back to being normal. B12 deficiencies are associated with certain types of neurological disturbances. So there's a fairly well-organized medical workup for somebody who has had some significant changes in their thinking and cognition. But it turns out that it's probably only 15 to 20% of folks who have a findable, reversible, fixable diagnosis that will make everything better. The other sort of 80% of the time, people have a dementing process that is not necessarily reversible. Some of those folks will stay about the same. Some of them, unfortunately, will get considerably worse over time. There isn't a specific test for Alzheimer's as such. It's usually a diagnosis reached by the process of elimination and made over time as one observes the person's behavioral changes. But short-term memory loss by itself would really raise the question of what other medical factor has changed here recently that's impairing this person's ability to function well. And as such, is not a final diagnosis and would, in fact, warrant some additional investigation.
All right. Well, I hope that that helps. If the caller would like to call back, ask some follow-up questions, she certainly may. And other people who are listening are also welcome to call, too. Our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And every other month, he's here for the show. We call and talk to the family doctor because the idea is that it's kind of wide open. And whatever might be on your mind, you can give us a call and talk with him. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, I was thinking about that perhaps comes under this heading of symptoms that should not be ignored might indeed be, could eventually be related to some concerns about dementia and mental functioning, and that is stroke. And I'm thinking particularly about the kind of stroke that would not be immediately debilitating, but something where maybe the person would feel some temporary functional issues, and then that would go away. And then they would think, well, gosh, I'm not sure what that was, but I guess I feel okay now, and they'll just go on. What are the symptoms that you should look for that if something like that happens and you just feel you're even not sure, but you think, well, something sort of odd happened. When would you say, call the doctor, go in, tell them about it, tell them what happened, and just have them check you over?
In most instances, the situation you describe is consistent with what gets labeled TIA, transient ischemic attack. On a temporary basis, not enough oxygen was getting to your brain. And as such, that portion of the brain that controls some form of bodily function isn't working well or normally. And people will say, gee, you know, I lost the vision in an eye. I had numbness, tingling, and weakness in an arm or a leg. And it is functionally impairing for the length of time that the symptom is present. Fortunately, for the vast majority of people who have TIAs, well, actually by definition, it's going to go away within 24 hours. Uh-huh. And even if it does go away, it's still a significant event in the sense that individuals who have TIAs are statistically much more likely to go on to have major strokes. And a major stroke is simply a TIA that doesn't go away. You've blocked off the blood vessel or in some way impaired the oxygenation to that portion of the brain, and then you lose that function of the part of the body that the brain controls. And so those really shouldn't be ignored because there's, again, a fairly formal set medical workup to find out, why did I have my TIA? Do I have all of the risk factors for blood vessel diseases, and one of my blood vessels in my brain is finally plugged up? Did I have some sort of partial blockage in my carotid artery in my neck, and a piece of that broke off and traveled in my circulation and got stuck in my brain because the blood vessel got smaller and it couldn't get through? The same thing can be said about clots that originate in the heart. They too can be pumped up into the brain. So there's a whole workup primarily geared at cerebral cardiovascular disease risk factors, trying to identify, is there an underlying cause for this? And obviously, if you find it, you try and fix it, because there is good evidence that that then reduces the subsequent risk for stroke.
Okay. And so that there, if you have somebody that has had one of these, then I guess I'm, and maybe because it's the same mechanism that underlies heart disease, then do you think about, for example, putting that person on statins, or do you address it in the same way?
In the vast majority of cases, you're looking at the same risk factors as you would for heart disease, and so you'd like to get that person to stop smoking. You'd like to get that person's blood pressure under good control. You'd like their cholesterol to be down. This is one of the situations where that aspirin a day is probably helpful, because it helps prevent platelet aggregation that helps formulate clots. So, yes, in many instances, the risk factors and the treatment are very, very similar. Yeah.
Well, we have several other people, and we'll get back to the phones and start in again with line one. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
We have a situation, my wife and I, we're trying to figure out. Perhaps you can help us. My son is 3 and a half, and he's scheduled for a tonsillectomy. And it was suggested he do that, although the symptoms aren't severe. And when we went in to talk to the surgeon, he stated that the first thing out of his mouth really was that he can wait. And I can only assume that when he said to wait, that would be that maybe another year, since he's 3 and a half, the post-op would go much smoother if he had another year under his belt. So while my wife and I are trying to figure out what's the advantage of waiting versus maybe a rough year of possible emergency with the tonsils over the winter.
What was the original reason for scheduling the tonsillectomy?
They were enlarged. They were just simply enlarged. After he had a virus, they never did go back down, but they're not necessarily obstructing breathing right now.
And in terms of recurrent strep throats, has that been a problem?
He's had it once.
Once.
And it's toward the latter end of the winter. And so we were looking at, if we do let it go, is it highly likely that a occurrence of strep would occur again? And we may end up having a two-week emergency operation, in the middle of winter.
No, not necessarily. And in fact, strep in children, a couple times a year doesn't fall outside of the, quote, usual range.
Okay.
Anyway, typically for strep throat, we're usually looking at the kid who's had 5 or 6 documented strep tonsillitis infections. We're looking at the kid who got an infected tonsil and it didn't go down. He had an abscess. We're looking at somebody whose tonsils are so big that they say, gee, I have trouble swallowing, I have trouble breathing. These kids oftentimes have disordered sleep because of abnormal breathing, again, because their airway is compromised. If you have a situation where the tonsils are simply enlarged, the usual occurrence over time is as kids get physically bigger, their tonsils get relatively smaller. So airway obstruction becomes less and less of an issue. And truly, the only real reason for removal for infectious disease is either recurrent strep infections or a strep infection that you can't clear up without removing the tonsils, or if there's a, what's called a peritonsillar abscess, where, you just basically have to get in there and physically remove something. So what you've described so far certainly doesn't sound like that there's any urgency to having a tonsillectomy. And because tonsillectomies in and of themselves, when you look at the surgical risk and the anesthetic risk, while it is small, it's not zero. There are no surgical or anesthetic procedures with a zero complication rate. As I often tell people, there's nothing in life with a zero complication rate. But if there isn't any urgency here, I think waiting and seeing how things go over another year or so is perfectly reasonable.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thank you. There would have been time when it was much more common to remove tonsils. Today, how often does that?
It is much less frequent now than it used to be, 30, 40 years ago. There was some presumption that, gee, if you just took somebody's tonsils out, they'd never get strep again. Well, it just doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. You can still end up with basically strep pharyngitis. The back of your throat will simply become infected. Your tonsils won't be swollen because they're gone, but it certainly doesn't prevent you from having the infection.
Mm-hmm. Champaign County is next. This is line 2. Hello.
Hi. This will probably be more complicated, complicating than illuminating, but I thought since you encouraged people to call and ask about something, I experienced something I'd never experienced before. It was a cool night. I wasn't feeling terribly unwell, though I have subsequently felt like I'm fighting something off. But I did a little over-exercise and strained a I had a cramp in the middle of the night, and I addressed that, and then just by stretching a little bit, I laid back down, and I had these convulsive shivers, and I wasn't feeling feverish. I don't know what was going on, And it was one of these bizarrely cool nights, and I did have fans on, and the window was... So I was probably chilled some, but I'm just wondering, I thought about if I was still feeling bad today, I'd go to a convenience care or get some kind of information, but...
You mentioned
something related to something else other than the fact that I was just maybe a little hypothermic, or what do you think?
Okay.
Is there anything you can say?
Okay. On the basis of that, there's not much I can say. The information that your physician or other healthcare provider takes into consideration, gender.
Past history and all sorts of things.
Yeah. Age. Previous diagnoses, current medications, drug allergies, things that tend to run in your family. And then with that as a background, you interpret somebody's symptoms in that context.
Right.
And so a particular symptom in a given individual may mean absolutely nothing, yet in another individual with an entirely different set of circumstances may be highly significant. So in your particular case, the cramp you mentioned was in your...
A sort of upper thigh was an odd place, but I'd been doing some fairly probably overstrenuous bike riding.
And certainly those muscles would be actively used in that activity.
I don't think it was related, but it was just so coincident that I mentioned it.
And the shivers, as you put it, was throughout the entire body, or just again in that particular area?
The whole body. Okay. I mean, I covered up, found a winter cover, and covered up for a while, and it stopped, and I sort of fell back asleep. So I think it was just really kind of a bizarre episode, but since I did feel like I was fighting something off a lot the next day, it was very unsettling because it was just so, I'd never experienced anything like it before. And I've never shivered like that even when I've had a fever. So it was just, I don't know.
And subsequently, has that symptom been recurrent?
No. And so I don't know if, you know,
Our general rule is bad things don't go away by themselves.
Right.
So they come back, they're recurrent, they're persistent.
So, convenient care wouldn't really be very good because that wouldn't be a doctor that really brings my history with
correct.
Like my personal physician would.
Right. And
okay, well, I didn't think it was going to help, but...
But certainly anything recurrent or persistent, it is reasonable to get checked out. There are a wide variety of sort of odd things that occur to people on a one-time basis. And if it's just that, a one-time basis, it's usually not a disease process.
Yeah, I just wondered if you'd heard anything that could be a cover for another symptom, so it wasn't really... shivering in some way.
No.
But okay. Well, thanks.
Okay.
All right, very good. We're talking this morning with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carr Clinic in Urbana. He is here every other month for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And it is indeed an opportunity to call in here and ask questions about what might be going on with you or someone in your family. Give us as much information as you can, and the doctor will see what he can tell you. And then, as I said at the beginning of the program, you might indeed want to take this up with your own doctor or a doctor who can see you, but you can start here. He'll ask some questions. You can tell him what you can and go from there. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have another Champaign caller up next, and this is line number 3.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. Could you define narcolepsy and cataplexy? Is that related? Is it to epilepsy, or is that a brain thing, or what is the cure for it, or if there is, or what?
All the epsies are not related.
Okay.
So narcolepsy is sudden loss of consciousness as though somebody fell asleep.
Uh-huh.
Cataplexy is a loss of muscular tone. So they may not fall asleep, but they may indeed fall. They lose their muscular strength.
Uh-huh.
Epilepsy is actually a seizure disorder with abnormal electrical activity originating in the brain, causing then abnormal movements in the rest of the body. The first two, narcolepsy and cataplexy, are thought to fall into the sleep disorders category of medical diagnosis and are often evaluated either by physicians at a sleep laboratory and or neurology physicians. And fortunately, in many instances, there are neurologists who are trained in sleep medicine as well. And at Carl, we're quite fortunate to have several of these physicians to help sort out these. The first two, the narcolepsy and the cataplexy, are not necessarily common problems, but they can be quite confusing because the presentation is so odd. But it is not anything that is directly related to epilepsy.
Is there a medication that you could take to help it?
Yes, there are medications that are used in those situations to help prevent symptomatic episodes.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. The next caller is, Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for your program. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, Doctor, if you might talk a little bit about triglycerides and how we can lower triglycerides. And I just find it kind of a confusing topic in relation to cholesterol and all the other fats. Okay? Thank
Correct.
You.
Okay.
All right.
As the caller correctly pointed out, triglycerides and cholesterol are part of the fats that circulate in our bloodstream. Basically, the fat molecules are part of the building blocks for our cells. So you wouldn't want to have like no cholesterol or no triglycerides because that wouldn't be good. But in many instances, the metabolism of fat, and we're going to talk about cholesterol and triglycerides both, if significantly abnormal, leads to the abnormal deposition of fatty deposits in the lining of blood vessels. And so this contributes to plaque and the ultimate obstruction of blood vessels. And if this occurs in the heart, you get the typical, you know, blocked artery that can lead to heart attacks. This can also occur in other blood vessels in the body and impair organ function. Cholesterol has been very strongly linked to the development of heart disease, and that's why there's such a major emphasis to reduce cholesterol as a method of reducing heart disease. Triglycerides can also contribute, but have not been as strongly linked as cholesterol. What's often confusing to patients is that though they're both fats, from a dietary standpoint, they come from different areas. When we think of fats, we generally think of, you know, our fried foods and our greasy things and red meats. And those are the things that are typically asked to be reduced in a diet if somebody's working on their cholesterol. Triglycerides, on the other hand, from a dietary standpoint, often come from sweets and simple carbohydrates. So basically your donut and your white bread and your plain pasta are more a dietary source for triglycerides. The other major dietary source for triglycerides is anything with alcohol. So if you're having your beer and white bread, you're probably overdoing it with the triglycerides. And so from a dietary standpoint, it's sometimes confusing when somebody says, oh, you need to get your lipids down. Well, you need to be a little bit more specific about it. Well, is that my cholesterol? Is that my triglycerides? And unfortunately, for some people, it's both. And what we talk to people about is when you have your lipid panel, which usually includes your cholesterol and your triglycerides, and then the breakdown between what's referred to as your good and your bad cholesterol. When you have that done, you can't tell by looking at the numbers, is this the result of my diet? Is this a result of my exercise habits? Is this a result of genetic inheritance? And so basically all we can do is tell people, okay, here's some dietary instructions. We want you to get a little bit more exercise. If you're doing the right things, you're probably going to lose a little weight because we're going to end up cutting back on your calories. And come back in 3 or 4 months, and then we'll check your lipid panel again. If it's significantly improved, then that's probably an individual who simply needs to pay more attention attention to their lifestyle issues and probably is not a candidate for medication. On the other hand, if somebody says, you know, I run a marathon every day, I only eat rocks and sticks, you know, I'm being really, really good, and their cholesterol and or triglycerides really don't budge, that's probably somebody who has inherited a metabolic problem. Unfortunately, those are often the same families that then have a high incidence of heart disease, because you don't really inherit a bad heart. What you inherit is a tendency toward blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, and as those factors cumulatively over time take their toll, you end up with cardiovascular disease. So in individuals who have significant cardiovascular risk factors, can't make their lipids improve, or at least not significantly enough with diet and exercise, then those are the folks who then potentially become candidates for medication to bring that down, because there are many good studies that show getting it down does, in fact, reduce cardiovascular disease. Now, the ideal way to get it down is the diet and exercise, because there's so many other positive benefits to both of those activities that aren't included in the little cholesterol pill.
And I know that this is, again, just taking one piece of this, but because people have heard about good cholesterol, bad cholesterol, that the idea is that you actually want to get the ones down, but the other ones, the HDLs, those are the good ones, you'd like actually to have that.
Yes, and people forget these all the time. They can't remember which one's which. So your HDL is your happy.
That's the one you want to have.
That's the one you want to have a lot of.
Okay.
And your LDL, the L is lousy.
Lousy, okay. And is it still the case that the only way that we can get our happy cholesterol up is exercise?
To a large extent, that is really true. It's thought that the omega-3 fatty acids that naturally occur in fish may benefit that. So for folks who can't eat salmon 7 days a week, the fish oil supplement is something that is reasonable to try. Niacin has been used to help with cholesterol as well. Again, many people can't tolerate high-dose niacin, but for folks who can, that's often a benefit. But exercise, really, if you had to pick one thing, is probably the key thing to raising somebody's HDL.
Okay. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone calling up in the Chicago area in Des Plaines, so we'll go there. It's line four. Hello.
Oh, yes. Good morning, Doctor. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you a question. Almost 2 years ago, I had a biopsy taken on the temples, both sides, and I unfortunately diagnosed with the giant cell arteritis.
Mm-hmm.
And they put me on some high doses of prednisone.
All right.
And gradually reduced them over a year's period. I was doing the response that I got, the aches in the shoulder, the hips, the knees, you know, it was like a miracle drug. It disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And even disappeared as the levels were being reduced. However, when I got to approximately 5 and under, maybe it was okay at 5, but under 5, gradually I could feel these pains coming back in the same areas. It got to the point when I was down to 1, I went back to the doctor, reported everything, and my thought was, I think I got to go back on a higher dose, not the ultimate higher that I was at, but maybe back to 10 or something like that. I was very reluctant to do that, but ultimately, after a month or so of seeing him about it, we finally did go back to 10, and I presume that we will gradually lower it again. My question, I guess, revolves around what is the significance if this time around we lower it, and what sort of prognosis do I have if we once again get down to the lower numbers and some of these things, these pains in the areas I mentioned start coming back to me. I mean, number one is, I guess that's possible to happen again, and I'm a little concerned if it does. I I don't think it's a good idea to be on prednisone, but it's the one that seems to work for me.
Correct.
It's a dilemma. Can you tell me what your thoughts might be about that?
Sure. And you're correct. It's oftentimes a negotiation between you and your physician, because the two of you are really sort of between a rock and a hard place. The inflammatory nature of your diagnosis, giant cell arteritis, is often referred to as temporal arteritis.
Yes.
And it is, in fact, very commonly, almost universally treated with prednisone or cortisone type medication to reduce that inflammation. When the inflammation comes down, your symptoms subside, and the goal is to ultimately try and get you off of it if at all possible. But the reality is that, as you found, for many individuals, when they drop below a certain dose, their symptoms start to come back. Your suggestion to go up to the lowest dose that allows you to be comfortable is quite reasonable, with the idea that when things are under control again, you're going to again try and slowly taper the prednisone down. And in some instances, that tapering is, you know, no faster than dropping a milligram off of your dose every month. You know, so it could take you, you know, it could take you 10 months to get off of a 10 milligram dose.
And actually, that the first course of treatment actually was even longer than that.
Right.
12 months, I think, or something like that.
Right. And the reason the prednisone isn't just sort of given at high dose continuously is the potential side effects related to at least higher dose prednisone for longer periods of time involve things like high blood pressure and diabetes and ulcer disease and weight gain and fluid retention. So there are some adverse metabolic effects that come from the use of the prednisone on an ongoing basis.
At higher doses, you say?
Especially at higher doses, and also proportional to the length of time that you're taking it. So trying to get down to a lower dose, if at all possible, is quite reasonable. The other thing your physician is thinking about is prednisone will suppress the normal cortisone production of your own adrenal gland. And so you can't abruptly stop somebody's prednisone for fear that their own adrenal gland won't kick back in and start doing what it's supposed to do. So in this particular setting, it's unfortunate that your symptoms started to come back, but it's not necessarily unusual. Going at a lower dose and tapering slowly is quite common. In some instances, individuals can benefit from a low dose taken only every other day, and that will also tend to minimize then the effects on the body's own adrenal gland. And I don't know if you've discussed that with your physician or not, but at some point where we, for other conditions as well, where we're using prednisone long-term, if we can get to another every other day schedule with the medication, that's often a nice compromise position to be in.
Is a low dose something less than 10, less than 5? Or
low dose would be less than 5.
Less than 5, okay. And if you are in a situation where 5 seems to be satisfactory, but going below 5, does that suggest that this thing could go on for years, I mean, rather than another episode, which I'm going through right now, but it is responding to the 10 milligram.
Mm-hmm. And the symptoms that you experience and the laboratory work that you get done, I imagine you're getting your SED rate,
yes,
and CRP checked periodically. Those numbers will also help measure objectively the degree of inflammation in your system and also help guide the ability to change the dose, ideally downwards.
Are those two items, if you allow me to ask another related question, are those two measures that they use, are they in any way measured vis-a-vis age, so that a higher number for one age category would be acceptable, but for another age category would not be acceptable, or is it irrelevant what age?
Actually, it tends to go up a little bit with age. So there is some adjustment in terms of the interpretation of the test based on age.
It is, and is this all revolving around, let's say, some, if I can call it that, a dysfunction with the adrenal glands not making enough of its own prednisone or something like that?
It doesn't appear to be, no.
So inflammation can come from any place in the body then, I guess.
That is correct.
Okay, and being someone who has a 3 angioplasties, I'm concerned about its effect on the inflammation, I presume, is pretty... It's not a nice thing for somebody who has undergone 3 angioplasty and has to worry about the coronary arteries in general.
Well, that's true. And the other thing that your physician is weighing the effect of, you know, what is the prednisone doing to your blood pressure? You know, what's it doing to your blood sugar? Because those two are risk factors for recurrent cardiovascular disease. So there's this, you know, constant sort of push and pull of the benefits versus the potential risks of the medication. And it's something that the two of you are simply going to have to negotiate over time, looking at short-term benefits versus long-term risks.
Well, you've been very generous with your time, and I thank you. It's been most helpful.
You're welcome.
Good. Thank you. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he's here on the program. Always on a Monday. It's for this show we call Talk to the Family Doctor, and we have some other questions, and we'll get in as many as we can in the time that remains. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think someone here in Champaign is next, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I have a problem with my left hand. 3 of the fingers get numb now and then, a few times a week. What could that be?
Which fingers are we talking about?
The pinky, the ring finger, and the middle finger.
Huh. Okay. That distribution suggests pressure on what's called the ulnar nerve. That's the nerve that runs down from your neck into your arm, down the inside part of your elbow. What people often refer to as their funny bone when they hit it is the sensation of tapping on the ulnar nerve. And you get that feeling of electrical sensation going down your forearm. But numbness and tingling in those 3 fingers would most commonly be attributed to pressure on the ulnar nerve. This is something that can occur either at the wrist, where the nerves run through there and often get sort of pinched with repetitive bending of the wrist, or also can occur at the elbow, where the nerve comes around the corner made when you flex your and again bend your elbow. And occasionally it can be coming from a little higher as far up as pressure on the nerve from the neck. So if this is something that was temporary related to an activity where you put some pressure on it, in many instances, within a few weeks it will subside by itself.
This has been going on for about 4 months.
If it doesn't resolve within about 6 weeks, you went from what we refer to as acute symptoms to now a more chronic condition. And if it is in fact persistent, then it's time to go have that looked at and checked out.
By whom?
You can start with just your primary physician. The basic neurological testing is part of the physical examination in the office setting. An additional test that is often used to help sort out whether this is a pressure on the nerve kind of problem is referred to as an EMG, which is an electromyogram.
What is EMG?
Mm-hmm. An EMG and nerve conduction velocity test are electrical tests done on the nerve, and these are usually done by a neurologist and interpreted by them. But the physical examination findings and any additional testing will usually help identify whether this is a significant problem with pressure on that nerve.
Yeah, this is not a TIA.
No.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll continue next to talk with someone in the Chicago area. This is line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question about, you know, I bumped my leg on a big toolbox handle about 3-4 months ago. You know, it was bruised up, you know, like, you know, you get a big scrape. And then now, like, I've always had this lump on the bone part, you know, like a lump. Is that something serious or just from it being bumped and you form a lump on your bone or something like that?
In general, what you've described sounds fairly typical for hematoma, basically a collection of blood as a result of the injury. It sort of congeals into a kind of a hard, you know, oftentimes what people would refer to as a goose egg initially. They generally resolve on their own. If it's still particularly tender, you know, several months later, it's probably worth looking at. If you just notice a bump and it's otherwise not bothering you, simply being patient, in many instances over a long period of time, they will gradually resolve.
So it's nothing serious?
Correct.
Because, I mean, I bruised up my lower leg. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I scraped the skin and had a little blood coming from it and that. And then, you know, I didn't have any pain after that, you know, after it healed, but then I just had this, like, goose egg, small
right.
goose egg.
And that can often be just material that was released as a result of the injury sort of congealing underneath the skin there. It's not going to get into a blood vessel. It's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to otherwise cause you any harm.
So, I mean, if you're not having any pain or any symptoms or anything, like, it's not going to be no harm or anything. It'd just be like looking like you've got a goose egg on your leg, right?
Right.
So just really don't worry about it type of thing?
If it's not hurting you, I would tell you that it's perfectly okay to just observe it. If in any way it's getting bigger or producing symptoms, the longer you are away from the original injury, the less likely we can blame it on the injury. But given the time sequence that you described, this is probably just a result of that.
Yeah, it's been almost like three, four months mm-hmm. back end of first part of May type of thing. But it's probably 3/4 inch or something like that, a small goose egg, maybe up to 3/8, you know, mm-hmm. 1/16 of an inch, less than 1/4 inch, something like that.
Right. It should continue to gradually subside over time as your body reabsorbs that material.
But it'll just take a while, but nothing serious, right?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Something that I'm thinking about, we were talking earlier, someone called in and asked the question about cholesterol. And I think that people probably have, you know, they've heard the lecture about things like what constitutes healthy lifestyle and things that you ought to be concerned about. And I was thinking just about the fact that the other day, one of your colleagues here, Dr. Hill, who's a pediatrician, mm-hmm. was here on the program. And we were talking particularly about the growing concern about issues of weight and children and, you know, the fact that we're seeing kids that are heavier and we're getting into issues of diabetes and so forth. And so we were talking about, I guess at one point we were talking about the idea of the BMI, the body mass index, mm-hmm. which is a calculation based on weight and height.
Correct.
And it gives you a number.
Right.
And so that's kind of a benchmark number to, you know, to think about, well, am I overweight or not? He said, though, that there is another thing that they look at, and that's the distance around your waist. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are probably a lot of guys who would look at themselves and say, well, overall, I'm not doing too bad, except the problem is, you know, I have this area of fat on my stomach that seems to be, that's a really stubborn kind of a thing once you get fat right. there. At what point would you say to somebody, well, yeah, you'd say, I'm not overweight, but you have this big belly, and that's a real issue.
Statistically speaking, for adult males, a waist size of 40 inches or more puts you into a higher risk category for cardiovascular disease. Interestingly enough, the distribution of that fat does make a difference, and men more commonly have what is referred to as truncal obesity. They're basically heavier from you know, the chest and abdominal area. Women often tend to carry their weight in the buttocks and thighs, and that sort of more pear-shaped distribution of fat seems to be less of a cardiovascular risk factor for the same amount of weight for a given height. So in men, a waist size over 40 would indeed by itself be a cardiovascular risk factor. Looking at BMI to see the proportionality of height and weight is a good place to start, though you have to do some adjustments for body build. You know, a football player is probably going to have a BMI that's outside of the recommended range, but for his particular activity, he probably needs that for right now. Now, whether that turns out to be heavy and you know, beneficial in the long run is debatable. But most folks, the BMI should be somewhere between 18 and 25. Between 25 and 30, you're considered overweight. Above 30 is considered obese. And above 40 is what we refer to as morbidly obese. And those are the folks who then potentially become candidates for things like bariatric surgery, especially if they have other risk factors that are aggravated by their weight.
Yeah. Well, why is it that in men, that area where the fat likes to go, it's so difficult to get that to shrink up?
If I had the answer to that, I would have been awarded the Nobel Prize and probably have made, you know, millions of dollars.
You're a rich man.
Exactly. All those infomercials that you see on TV trying to sell you something always say, well, we target this particular area. I personally don't know of anything that targets that particular area. In general, folks basically need to follow the, as you already alluded to, eat less, exercise more type routine. And to be perfectly honest, it gets more and more difficult as you get older to be able to maintain that. Mm-hmm. And some folks find it very, very difficult. But a lot of it isn't rocket science. You know, if you're not losing weight, then you need to eat less and exercise more. Mm-hmm. So there isn't any magic shortcut that I'm aware of.
Well, we'll have to leave it with that. Sorry, folks, no magic shortcuts today. I'm Jeff Swearingen, our guest. He's a family practice doctor at Carr Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he's here for the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.